From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories, an hour of storytelling from veterans and soldiers.
This is what I wanted to be, company commander of Alpha Company 1504.
And every one of those soldiers that I have met in my life, I see the reflection of my son in their eyes.
Over the next hour, we'll hear four stories recorded in front of a live audience at the Airborne and Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There are stories about service, bravery, and sacrifice.
The day you died, I had been in denial that anything serious had happened.
A veteran is someone who at some point has written a blank check to the United States of America for up to and including our lives.
Fort Bragg Stories, a special program made possible with support from the Bob Woodruff Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the contributions of WUNC listeners. North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories. We're recording this program in front of a live audience at the Airborne and Special Operations Museum in downtown Fayetteville, North Carolina. It's an hour of storytelling about life in and around Fort Bragg and is part of American Homefront, a national reporting initiative on veterans and military issues. The project is made possible with support from the Bob Woodruff Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and from the contributions of WUNC listeners. Bill Watford was working as a nurse with the 5th MASH unit in 1989 when he got the call to deploy for Operation Just Cause. In a matter of hours, he went from operating room at Womack Army Hospital to a surgical tent at the end of a runway in Panama, waiting for combat wounded to roll in. Bill Watford.
Hi, y'all. In my den, there's a chest. It's made out of solid oak and was handmade for me by my grandfather. It was intended for me to store my toys as a child. I still have that box, but over the years, it became a storage place for memos and letters and after-action reviews, newspaper articles, magazines, magazine stories, for things that dealt with Forward Surgical Team, the invasion of Panama, and Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Unintentionally, it became somewhat of a metaphor for placing emotions I didn't want to deal with at the time away. I knew they were there, but I just didn't choose to deal with them for many decades. A little bit of a background on how I got to Panama and over in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I graduated from high school in 1969. I immediately went to NC State, where I stayed for about a year and a half, amassing a grade point of 0.7. Yeah. Well, after a year and a half, NC State asked me to take my academic endeavors elsewhere. For those of you that were around, Vietnam was going hot and heavy in 69 and 70. I had a very low draft number, and it wasn't a matter of if I was going to be drafted. It was only a matter of when I was going to be drafted. So I'd been talking to the Air Force, and in January of 1971, I went on active duty, went through my basic training, went to tech school to become a helicopter mechanic. They sent me up to Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane, Washington, and I worked with a pararescue unit there. When I got out of my enlistment for the Air Force, I knew I wanted to go back and get my college degree, so I went to Washington State, and I had chosen nursing as my career field. I graduated from Washington State with a Bachelor of Science and a 3.5 GPA. So it's amazing how easier it gets when you're really interested in what you're doing. My senior year, the recruiters came around, and I decided I wanted to go in the Army. I wanted to go back into military service. And I wanted the operating room to be my area of emphasis. So I went back in. I was trained by the Army, and I worked in community hospitals. I worked in large medical centers. I worked in field hospitals. And in 1987, I got my dream job. I came back to Fort Bragg, and I was assigned to the 5th Mobile Army Surgical Hospital right here in Fayetteville. At the same time frame, the 44th Med Brigade was working on an innovative, totally exciting concept called forward surgical teams. As we were going along and we were demonstrating our capabilities, we came to the attention of the special ops community on Fort Bragg. And they felt, I assume they felt, that we occupied a niche between their very robust, very dynamic initial insertion package and a later arriving larger medical unit. The FSTs fit right in the middle just perfectly. So at O'Dark 30, on the morning of December 19th, 1989, the Ford surgical team and myself found ourselves in the dimly red-lit interior of a C-141 Air Force cargo plane headed to the Republic of Panama. We'd been flying for several hours, and the intercom crackled, and the pilot came over, and he said, "I am beginning my combat descent into Howard Air Force Base." And almost immediately, he nosed that sucker into about a 45-degree down angle, and down we went. Well, Bill, our nurse anesthetist, asked nobody in particular, "Do you think there are any aircraft guns can reach us up here?" Well, out of the gloom came about three or four responsive, "Shut the hell up, Bill." But we made it down safely. And as the sun came up over Howard Air Force Base, we were set up and we were operational and ready to go for the invasion that was supposed to start at 0100 the next day. In combat, at least the part that I saw, the casualties don't come in a steady stream. They come in ebbs and flows. And depending on the intensity of the combat operations, we would see the wounded an hour or so later. I remember one fella in particular. His unit had been ambushed by the PDF. Four of his unit had been killed. Nine had been wounded, several grievously, including this young man. We got him on our OR table, and we worked on him feverishly for several hours. But unfortunately, we couldn't save him. We were crushed. I mean, literally crushed. But there's other wounded out there that need us to take care of them. So we quite literally wiped the tears out of our eyes, took out our mental box, our mental box with little compartments in it, and we took that crush and that frustration, and we put it in one of the boxes, one of the drawers. We closed the drawer, closed up the box, took a deep breath, and we went on and we took care of the rest of the wounded. I imagine that civilians go through a similar experience when they're taking care of mass casualty situations like the recent Las Vegas shooting. You have to become professionally detached. You have to open your box, you have to open the drawer, you have to put your emotions inside and you close it, because you don't want your emotions to impair your judgment or your physical skills. There's a meme that floats around Veterans Day on social media that goes something like this. A veteran is someone who at some point in their life has written a blank check to the United States of America for up to and including our lives. This creates a bond and a comradeship amongst members of the military, and it's a bond that I think transcends what the civilians experience. I kept that box closed for decades, literally decades. I couldn't tell that story I just told you without breaking up. And I couldn't continue the story. The first time I finished that story is when I was talking to Jeff, our storytelling coach. So I've been able to take both that literal box that's in my den and my mental box, and I've been able to gingerly open them, and I've been able to look at some of the items inside. I can tell the story of the young man now without breaking up, and I can smile a little bit because I remember all of the lives that we did save and all of the lives that have been saved by forward surgical teams throughout the Army over the decades. And I don't dwell so much on the one fellow that we lost. Thank you.
From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories. I'm Eric Hodge. Next up, Yoli Betancourt has served in the Army for more than 23 years. It's a job she loves, but it comes at a personal cost. Since the birth of her son, she's fought to balance motherhood with her lifelong dedication to military service. Yoli Betancourt.
I feel lucky to be a woman. Most importantly, I feel lucky to be a female warrior. My professional name is Master Sergeant Judy Yolanda Espinoza Betancourt. My friends and family call me Yoli. And as I reflect on this great adventure called life, I'm still pretty amazed on how I got where I am right now in my life. You see, I come from a very diverse background. My father is from Peru, South America, and in the late 1960s, he ended up going to Murray State University in Kentucky as a foreign exchange student, and that's where he met my mother, who was Caucasian, and she was studying to be a teacher. And they did something that was pretty taboo at that time. They fell in love, and they got married, and they moved to Paducah, Kentucky. Well, 2 years later, I grace the world with my presence. And as my mother tells me this story many, many times, it's interesting because I really do think at that time I had warrior tendencies because I almost died. My poor mother, she suffered miserably for over 24 hours for hard labor. And considering I'm really a hard-headed woman, hard heads do run in our family, so I'm really sorry, Mom, about that suffering. I finally came out, and the very, very intoxicated doctor picked me up by my feet, right? And he was slapping me. I chose not to respond. I wasn't breathing. I wasn't doing anything. And there's my poor mother laying there, thinking I'm dead. She's gone through all that suffering. And I was actually really aggravating the doctor because why? He wanted to go get his drink on. So with that being said, after that seventh slap, he hauled off and knocked the craziness out of me. Well, according to my mother, I didn't cry. I screamed because I was pissed off. I was ready to fight the doctor, according to her. So when she told me that story, and I reflect on it right now, that kind of shows me that I was a warrior right then and there. Part of the warrior ethos. You never accept defeat and you never quit. The years go by, and I end up going to the University of Kentucky, and I was studying to play the viola. Yeah, playing the viola. Let me tell you about that experience in regards to the orchestra. I sucked. You know, I was no virtuoso. So I knew I wasn't going to make money playing the viola in the orchestra, and I was lost in the sauce. I was 24 at the time, not sure what I was going to do with my life. And so my wonderful Aunt Connie, she told me, would you consider joining the military? And I kind of looked at her like she was on liquid crack. You know, I'm like, I don't know about that. However, that's when I happened to meet Staff Sergeant Hernandez. Wow, he was fine. He was all that in a bag of Dorito chips. That's how fine he was. He got my attention real quick. I was mesmerized. He looked amazing in that uniform. He articulated his words. He explained the Army life. And I loved how confident he was and how professional. And I thought to myself, I want to be like him. I know I would look amazing in that uniform. I'm going to join the Army. One problem, I knew my dad was going to give me a hard time. So my course of action was not to say anything. I would wait after. So I went to MEPS, signed the contract, took the oath, and when I knew I was a property of the United States Army, then that's when I told my father, and my mother as well. Went to basic training in 1993 at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And I was one of the very last segregated female companies, and we were taught by all combat armed drill sergeants. All I'll say about that experience is that I thought I was in hell and I was going to die. But I did graduate, maneuvered to Fort Sam Houston, and became a preventive medicine technician. And I started my Army career. Several years down the road in Fort Knox, Kentucky, around the year 2000, I met my husband, who was a staff sergeant at the time. We fell in love, and he wanted to get married. However, one condition. There was no way we were going to have children. Understand that. Never, ever, ever, ever are we going to have kids. But regardless of what your religious background is, God, Great Spirit, whatever you want to call it, I believe wholeheartedly God has a really interesting sense of humor, and I got schooled. I know you're going to roll your eyes, and just bear with me. My husband and I, we used a unique form of birth control. It was called the calendar method, and it was working pretty good, actually. You know, you count the days, and when you're ovulating, you're more precautious, or you don't show affection towards your spouse. How, understand this, I really suck at math, okay? I really almost failed that part on the ASVAB. So needless to say, that old motto, shit happens, yeah, it does. Several weeks down the road, I'm not feeling right, PT, you know, I'm not able to run, I can't figure it out. And I happen to be at the store, and I look over to my left, and guess what? There's a sale. When you buy two pregnancy tests, you get the third one for free. And what girl doesn't like a sale, right? So I got them, even though Miss I'm Never Going to Have Kids knew that she wasn't pregnant. But you have to understand where I'm coming from, right? Every parent that I saw, they looked like they were cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Always chasing the little kids around, they're brats, they're sick, they're tired all the time, and I don't have time for that nonsense. I knew that I was a selfish woman. I value my time, money, my sanity. So there was no way that it was in my calling to be a mother. I get into the bathroom at home, right? And I've really never taken a pregnancy test because I know I'm not pregnant. And so you have to read the instructions, and you're going through this whole spiel. And so my NCO mind was coming into effect. You kind of have to correlate taking a pregnancy test by, you know, qualifying on an M4, a moving gauge, moving target. And so as I am trying to get, you know, deal with this pregnancy test and aim appropriately and, you know, put the urine on it. Remember, that's a mission in itself. I accomplished the mission, and I put it on the sink, and I'm waiting for the results. I'm a diverse leader, so I'm able to call one of my girls and talk to her on the phone. you know, just cutting away. And then I look over, and I happen to see two lines. Two lines. What? I hang up on my girlfriend. She was mid-sentence. I just hung up on her. Two lines. There's something not right. Remember, I'm an NCO, so there's something wrong with this. This is defected. And what does a good leader do? Verify, verify, verify. I had the two other pregnancy tests, and you better believe I took both of them. They all came up hot. I was pregnant. So it took us about 2 weeks to get used to the idea that I was pregnant. I kept on having this terrible thought in my mind. You know, the Aliens movie, the first one? I had a parasite in my body, and it's going to explode out at any time. But honestly, after 2 weeks, I came to grips with it. And being pregnant was actually a really great experience for me. I enjoyed it immensely. I was glowing. I was jovial. I finally had a chest. And one thing I really did like is the fact that not only was I a female warrior, but I was a sexy female goddess, fertile goddess. And I think I looked pretty good looking in that maternity outfit that they gave to us in the Army. So the months go by, and as an NCO and a soon-to-be mother, sometimes it was very hard for me to distinguish between the two. Because I remember I would talk to my unborn child, especially when he would try to keep me up in the middle of the night. He would break dance in my stomach, and I'm pretty tired. And all of a sudden, like my drill sergeant stuff started coming out. I'm like slapping on the stomach. Hey, Joker, at ease that nonsense. Lights out. Come on, stop moving. So it's kind of funny because the poor kid's not even born, and I'm talking to him like he's a private. Anyway, the day comes, and it's time for me to deliver. And that experience right there showed me that my son was a warrior as well, because he too almost died. You see, when he came out, the umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck, not once, not twice, but three times. And the doctor started to panic because they thought he was dead. And my husband, as I looked over to my husband, he was like this hardcore sergeant first class and holding on to the rail of the hospital bed because he was so afraid, because he couldn't figure out how he was going to tell me that our child was dead. However, a nurse took charge of the situation who was also a female warrior. She said, "Hey, doc, I got this. Give me the baby." She took that baby. She did something kind of gag reflex with her finger, rubbed him down, and he chose to breathe. He chose to live. And so they take that baby and they wrap him up and they put him in my arm. And I'm looking at this life. I gave life. And I realized I wasn't only lucky to be a woman and lucky to be a female warrior. I was lucky to be a mother. I had been given the honor and privilege to be a mother. And I was in awe. And as I was holding my newborn infant and he was looking at me with his black hair and black eyes, and I was looking at him, I started talking to God a lot in my mind. And I said, "God, I know it's asking a lot, okay, I know. But please give me a couple of years with my child, please. And then you send me wherever you want me to go." You see, as a female warrior, once we give birth, we have maternity leave for about 6 weeks. We're given 6 months to get back into shape, pass a PT test, and get ready to deploy. And if you're in a deployable unit, by God, you're going. I've seen it many times. As my sister-in-arms say goodbye to their children or their child, their baby that's only 6 or 7 months old. Saying goodbye and getting ready to go in harm's way, not knowing if they return, if their baby is going to remember who they are. Fortunately, at that time in my life, I was in a unit that didn't deploy, and I did get to stay with my baby for 2 years. And it was a blessing. I got to nurse him. I got to see him walk and spend holidays with him. But after those 2 years, it was time to deploy, and I have not been stopping. I've been going nonstop. I've dealt with a variety of recruits when I was an AIT platoon sergeant. I've mentored many NCOs out there. I've had an opportunity to make suggestions to our junior officers. And every one of those soldiers that I have met in my life, I see the reflection of my son in their eyes. And that gives me the motivation to do what I do right now, to be the best leader that I know how to be. So I've been away from my son for almost 11 years now, and he's 14. He lives in Fort Benning, Georgia with his father, and I'm here. But I know I still have a strong impact in his life, and I know I'm making a difference. He decided, now that he's a freshman in high school, he decided he was going to join JRTC, and he really enjoys doing that. When they have their little run formations or they're running in formation, he always goes out there and he's yelling the cadence. Don't give up, you got to deal with it. Don't give up, you got to deal with it. That was something I taught him when he was like 1 year old. So I know I'm definitely having an impact. But when people come up to him, you see, and they say, why are you in JRTC? He holds his head up high and he says, because I'm going to become a warrior like my mother. Master Sergeant Ben Cordell, thank you.
From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories. I'm Eric Hodge. From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories. We're recording this program in front of a live audience at the Airborne and Special Operations Museum in downtown Fayetteville, North Carolina. It's an hour of storytelling about life in and around Fort Bragg and is part of American Homefront, a national reporting initiative on veterans and military issues. The project is made possible with support from the Bob Woodruff Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and from the contributions of WUNC listeners. Next up, Tom McCollum is a Fayetteville native born at Fort Bragg. He joined the Army to see the world, but by a twist of fate, ended up spending the bulk of his military and civilian careers at Bragg. Along the way, he's learned to negotiate complex relationships, both personal and professional. Tom McCollum.
Well, first off, I'd like to thank Bill. I also went to NC State, and finally I met someone who had a lower grade point average than me. I did graduate, but with 2.56, nothing stellar. My first assignment to Fort Bragg was in 1986, and I came to become the S1 or the adjutant for the 1st Battalion, 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment. I was thrilled to death. After years and years of being a leg, I was actually able to finally jump out of perfectly good airplanes for a living and receive jump pay. It was great. I hated the job, though. I did not like being the S1 in charge of admin and in charge of personnel. I wanted something more. The best thing, though, was that position got me ready for the one position that I can always look back and say, this is what I wanted to be. This is the perfect job, and looking back, it was for me. And I became the company commander of Alpha Company 1504. I got in there, And it was everything I was really hoping it would be. I finally got to look and get involved with soldiers on a much closer basis. By far, the one thing I can always look back and say that I mostly enjoyed was that I could see a soldier come on in from AIT, Advanced Individual Training, and he'd be brand new. This is his first assignment to Fort Bragg. And then over the years, we got to watch him develop into a leader, someone who was in charge of other soldiers, someone who was in charge of a lot of equipment, and someone who was in charge of getting missions done. And they did it. And it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. I had a battalion commander, Robert Killebrew, and he was the type who sat me down and said, basically, go out and use your imagination. Challenge your soldiers. And he was also the type that gave you enough rope that you could hang yourself. And many times he came up to me and loosened up the noose and took it away from my neck. One of the areas is we did morning PT, and we had this one challenge, and it took three times for him to realize we'd stop about a block and a half away from the company area. And I'd look over at him and say, if you can beat me back, PT is done. But if I beat anyone back in the company, PT will continue, and it'll just progressively get harder. The first time I'd run, they would run, I'd always beat them back. Second time, same thing. It was the third time someone finally realized what to do. We got ready to go. One guy grabbed me, threw me to the ground. The rest of the company bolted. The guy who grabbed me was the fastest one in the company. And I was pretty fast at the time. And then he'd see that the company was back in. He'd push me down even harder, and then, boom, he took off. And then I'd get up, and I'd trot in because I knew the challenge had been met, and they finally realized they worked as a unit to meet the challenge and meet the mission. I don't want to give you the impression that everybody in the company was hard charging. That was our goal. We didn't always make it. There was one guy, Cody White. Cody was the type that you never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. Yeah, we all know someone who you can go on up, and this person could sweet talk any woman in the bar, could go up and sell ice to an Eskimo in the middle of winter. That was a lot of people, but that was not Cody. Cody was the opposite. Cody, every time he opened his mouth, you broke into a cold sweat because you had absolutely no idea what was going to come out of there. Soon after I took company command, we were going to a formation, and the company commanders were out on Andrean Street, and the battalion command, the battalion headquarters was about 50 feet away. Doors were all closed, windows were all closed, and we're standing there talking, and all of a sudden we hear a loud, thunderous voice from inside the building just ripping someone apart. There was the sergeant major of the battalion, Roy Brown, and he was just tearing into someone, and we're all standing out there going like, who does he have? That was my introduction to White. Later that afternoon, he's in my office, and I'm talking to him. I said, what are you thinking? He says, I don't want to be here. I want out of the Army. I said, there. But with White, he had just signed a year earlier a three-year commitment. I looked at him and I said, all right, you want out? And he goes, yes, and I'm going to do everything that I can to get out. I looked at him and I thought, no, you're not. You can go ahead and try it, but I'm not going to let you out. You made a commitment to the United States Army. You are a grown man. You will fulfill that commitment. I'm not going to allow you to start a path in your life where you think you can make a commitment and then all of a sudden you can break it just because you don't want it anymore. And he looked at me and says, I'm going to get out. And he says, no, White, you're not going to get out. I'm not going to allow you to regret this. So I talked to the first sergeant. No platoon wanted White. All the three of the platoons in the mortar section all said, no, don't want anything to do with him. So I looked at him and said, okay, let's make him my radio telephone operator. As a company commander, I had two. One would talk to the battalion commander, and then the other would talk within the unit. So usually it's the senior RTO who talks to the battalion commander. White, he just came on board, and I made him the junior. So he talked to the platoon leaders. I made a point to make sure that all the RTOs fully understood how we operated and what my train of thought was for all the missions, so that they could clearly convey across the radio to the platoon leaders and everyone else what we were doing. So we're moving along, and there's January. We jumped into Holland Drop Zone, which is on the far west end of Fort Bragg. January, if you've never done it, jumping out of a plane over Holland Drop Zone, it is ice cold. And we are in the plane, and I can remember internally thinking, and no one, this is the first time I've ever said it out loud, thinking, oh, God, I hope there's high winds. Let there be high winds so that the jump would be scratched. We would go back and land. We'd get in the trucks, and we could be warm for maybe another hour. But the green light always came on when the doors opened up, and we went out. And on the inside, turn it off. On the outside, great, let's go. And I'd always made a point to turn into the guy next to me saying, hey, have a good jump. We went on out. We hit the ground. We got our assault objective, and then we started moving. And we did a mission, what's called movement to contact, where basically you know the bad guys are out there and you have to go find them. And we moved. We had the lead platoon up front, myself with my radio operators, the mortar section, and then two platoons in trail. We're moving along. The lead platoon, granted, we just jumped. It was an all-night operation, and now it's daylight. They were moving like they were on a Sunday stroll. And it was like, pick up the pace, get spread out. You know, and I kept going over with the platoon leader, pick it up, pick it up. And we're moving slow, and no one's doing anything. Well, about this time, the battalion radio goes off, and I hear Colonel Killebrew on the side, you know, Alpha 6, this is Red Devil 6, over. And I sit there and I go across, and, you know, I say, Red Devil 6, this is Alpha 6. And he goes, Alpha 6, this is Red Devil 6, over. And that let me know that he wasn't hearing me. He had a short in his radio system that he swore up and down he couldn't, he didn't have it. Well, all the company commanders, we could talk to ourselves over that net. And so we all knew it's not our system, it's his. So having been in this situation before, I knew he was going to start to get angry. And we're moving really slow. Things aren't going right. I talked to the platoon, telling them, move, move, move. And it's not really happening. And now the pressure's coming in from the battalion commander, you know, trying to reach me. And I know what's coming. So I looked at White and I said, you tell that effing platoon leader to get that GD platoon moving now. And about this time, I finally made contact with the battalion commander. And, of course, he's ripping me apart. He's chewing into me, and I hear White off to the side. Luck, you effing platoon leader. You better get your GD platoon going now. And about that time, I reached over. I let go of that handset, talking to the battalion commander half mid-sentence, and grabbed the other handset. And I pulled it back from him and looked at him, and White looks at me and says, I only did what you told me to do. A few years later, it was time for me to change command. And I really hated going. I loved that company. It was a great bunch of guys. But it was time for me to go. That's just the way the Army is. And I changed command, and I went over to the Special Forces qualification course. And after I passed that, I went in. I went somewhere, and I ran into the company commander who took my place. And I talked to him and saying, how's the company doing? And he said, well, you know, it took me a while, but the company is where I want it to be. And I looked and said, by the way, what about Cody White? Where's he at? He goes, oh, I kicked him out. That guy was a problem child. It's in there. I gave him dishonorable discharge. He is out of the Army. I wasn't surprised, but I was severely disappointed. White got what he wanted, but I always thought it was the wrong thing for him. A few years ago on Facebook, one of my soldiers got in contact with me, and he said, hey, Cody's sister's trying to find people who served with him to get stories. So I contacted her, and it ended up that her son really idolized Cody, really thought the world of him. But Cody had died a few years later, earlier of cancer. So I talked to her and relayed some of the stories. I cleaned some stuff up. You know, I wanted to make sure that Cody was a hero to his nephew. And then we got to talking some more, and she said, Cody always regretted being kicked out. He was something that he knew was not the best for him. And there, right after 9/11, he tried to re-enter, but because they had a dishonorable discharge, they weren't about to let him back in. Looking back there, as I said, that was my best assignment in the Army. And by far, the thing I liked about it the most was I was able to be involved with the soldiers in the development of them. But not only did they develop, was I able to develop them, but they also helped develop me. And along with my parents and my brothers and sisters, the teachers, my friends, my wife, and my stepdaughter, they helped make me who I am. But by far, all the soldiers I ever served with, and especially those in the 82nd, they made me who I am. They taught me a lot of personal interests and personal shortages of my life and things I needed to change to become a better person. And though they did, the one by far who developed me the most was Cody. Cody taught me patience, taught me what I think leadership. He taught me how to deal with people with a very diverse background and how to guide somebody. And I'll always be not only grateful and thankful to the soldiers I served with, but I definitely will always be thankful for having Cody White in my life. Thank you very much.
From North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, this is Fort Bragg Stories. I'm Eric Hodge. Captain Phil Sussman is a former scout platoon leader currently in the Special Operations Training Pipeline at Fort Bragg. 2 years ago, a training accident involving a soldier he knew only briefly changed his life. Captain Phil Sussman.
Staff Sergeant Popham, my intent today was to find a place and a time to process your death, honor your life, and figure out how you changed my life in ways I am yet to understand. I came out here today to a nature preserve near my house to sit by the water, and build you a small tribute of rocks, and reflect. The day you died, I had been in denial that anything serious had happened. And I know you had to take that route through the mountain pass. But couldn't I have gotten with the S2, the intelligence officer, and checked out the imagery, maybe insert precautions about the route, and push recommendations against it for an alternate route? I knew it was a night movement, but I just didn't think hard enough. And that was it. You died. And we continued training the next day. The boss needed someone to recover the vehicle. Once again, they chose me because I could be counted on. I went with Staff Sergeant Mefford. When we got there, I saw the NGS on its side. It was so quiet and mundane from afar. Our next task was to recover everything from the vehicle. Your radios, your fleece cap, your jacket, the assault packs of your crew, and everything not tied down. And then I got to your hatch, and I began to see the extent of how you died. Your striker drove up onto a rock. I imagine it slowly began to tilt to the right. Your side. I saw in my head you trying to duck down into the vehicle. You were caught by your kit. The bolt-proof thick glass was shattered. Your 50 cal was bent and stuck in a huge solid rock, like a sword in a stone. Everything was mangled. I saw your blood, and I could see you there one night earlier, laying split across the vehicle, pinned beneath it. After we gathered all your equipment from the truck, one of the DA civilians handed me a white trash bag. In it was your IOTV, split in half and covered in blood, along with everything else in the bag. I think I had to give it back for the investigation. I went back and I circled the vehicle for any other signs that you'd left behind. I can't remember if I found your watch or if someone handed it to me, but I was left holding the last personal effect you were wearing before you died. I put it in my chest pocket, right next to the laminated photo I always keep in it of my daughter whenever I was training, whenever I am training. I thought she might keep your soul safe in some way. It was the most important thing that I had ever carried in my life. When I got back into the Humvee, I cried to myself. I cried for you. I cried for me. I cried for my daughter. And I cried for the daughter you left behind. I knew she needed to have it. And it was my duty to bring that watch back safe. I'm not going to tell you about all the bullshit I had to deal with getting your equipment, your mangled weapon, and what was left of the vehicle back to safety. But I'll say my sadness turned to anger when I felt like me and Meph were the only ones who cared about the sanctity of your death. But I got your watch back to the first sergeant, and I entrusted him with getting it to your family. When the rotation was over, not even a mention of what I was made to do. Not a thank you, not an acknowledgement of what Meph and myself had done. I just looked at the guys getting coins and awards without any acknowledgement of the brutal work before or after your death. When we got back, Staff Sergeant Bailey gave me a bracelet. It said, "Watch over us, protect us," in honor of Christopher R. Popham. October 5, 1976, 24 September 15. I wore it right away, and I told myself that it was to serve as a reminder of taking planning and training seriously for and on behalf of the lives, the soldiers who execute my plans in the future. I wore it for a year, and now it stays on my bathroom mirror. I see it every day. I'm wearing it today as well. But even when I take it off, I know that I will never leave it behind, and it will never leave me either. Sergeant Popham, Chris, I hardly knew you, but now we are connected forever. You helped us plan the MGS gunnery. I sat with you in the tower once or twice. Maybe we had a casual conversation. You were the second death in the unit in less than 6 months. But you mean a hell of a lot to me now. They named the motor pool after you. And I heard they had a speech about you the other day, and your accident was mentioned casually in a warning in a safety brief, which made me irate. But I cried for you again today. I meditated on you this morning, and I relived the whole event on my walk today to come and write about you. I had another epiphany this morning. I've been wanting to buy a certain watch for the past 2 years. I looked and looked and looked online to find the perfect watch. And when I found it, I knew it was the one. But it cost $1,000 for the wind-up and $2,000 for the auto version. So I never bought it. I bought one from Amazon for $40. I didn't like it for some reason. It didn't feel right. And I returned it. But I realized this morning why I wanted that watch. First of all, it looks identical to the one that you were wearing. Second, I don't want my daughter to get a Garmin or a digital watch to remember me by if the tables turn and it's my turn to go. But I never realized that until this morning. That's the second epiphany in as many weeks about two separate deaths and how they affected me in subtle ways I didn't know were inside me. As time goes on, though, I hope to continue to realize these things that are hidden beneath the surface and do things to lighten the load in my chest and on my shoulders. But what is it that I really want to do? Is it helpful to buy a watch in the case that I die and it goes to my daughter? It's morbid. Maybe it's the wrong answer. Or maybe it'll bring me peace. You didn't know me, but I'm a spiritual man. I'm not sure I even believe God exists sometimes, but somehow I believe truly that you're watching over me and all of us. Your soldiers, your brothers in arms, and maybe next time I'm overseas and I get that feeling in my gut that something is wrong, maybe part of that will be you. I hope that you are at peace. I'm on a path to find mine. And though putting this on paper really only served to stir up some horrible memories, I wanted to take this day to honor your memory. You're not forgotten, nor will you ever be forgotten. I've heard it said before that as long as you live on in someone's memory, you're never gone. I hope to always keep you alive in some way. I'm torn now as well. Part of me wants to put this online to honor your memory and have more people read it and speak about you, the last moments of your life, and your effect on a soldier who you hardly knew. But I don't have to make that decision today. I will still continue to honor you, to speak your name, to love, and to tell those around me that I love them, and to do whatever I can to find peace in the world, within me and with my past. Be at rest wherever you are. And though we hardly met, I still love you as I love my military brothers. I want to finish this with a quote from the Bible, even though I'm Jewish, that was used after the deaths of two police officers in Tampa, where I'm from, and it always stuck with me through the years. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Thank you.
You've been listening to Fort Bragg Stories, recorded live at the Airborne and Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Thanks for listening. Fort Bragg Stories is part of American Homefront. That's WUNC's national reporting initiative on veterans and military issues. You can share your story about life in and around Fort Bragg at WUNC.org. It's a project made possible with support from the Bob Woodruff Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and from the contributions of WUNC listeners. I'm Eric Hodge.